I like creating models. So I'd like to suggest there's five different Sangha adjectives. And in a way, we're going to be... and these are five different ways of thinking about him, or five different ways in which he exists. So Sangha adjective number one is a man who was born in 1925, went to India in 1944, came back to the UK in 64, died in 2018. So a man who lived and died, a particular personality, a particular story. Sangharakshita number two is a man who inspired a Buddhist movement and has changed hundreds of thousands of people's lives. And this particularly is a man who, well, in his most decisive and influential phase of his life, so in his 40s and 50s, when he was kind of setting up and starting this Buddhist tradition, when he was at his most powerful, to use that language, most creatively alive. Then there's Buddhist Sangharakshita number three, a person who taught Buddhism, who taught the meditation techniques we were doing earlier, who taught about ethics and all of the different things, all the books out there, all of the stuff which we as order members tell you, which in some way we've learned from him, so Sangharakshita's teaching. Then there's fourthly, for Sangharakshita is a complex human being, a person who made mistakes. So some of you will be were very aware of the mistakes and the hurt that happened, in his life. So in some ways, we don't want to deny that. We actively encourage talking about that. But tonight, we're here to talk about the good, the positive in his life. Just a few weeks ago, we were talking more concretely, more in depth about the difficulties. So we're not seeking to deny them. But also today, we're celebrating the positive influence of his life. And then finally, Sangharakshita is a man who created a Buddhist world, who created a Buddhist community, which we all can participate in to as much or as little as we choose to. So those are the five different Sangharakshitas, five different aspects of his life. There's many more. I was talking about it with Singha Mati earlier, and she was saying there's also the Sangharakshita who can't be pinned down, which he liked to refer to. So tonight, we're focusing on... Because you spend a lot of time hearing about, well, the teachings of Buddhism, because they're kind of being implicitly taught all the time. So really tonight what we're doing is we're trying to get a bit more of a sense of the story of the man behind it, the man who lived, the man who died. So the reason I'm sitting here with Sunha Shraddha is because, well, partly because we're old friends. We've been friends for 18 years. Well, we met each other 18 years ago. We've been friends for 10 years, 11 years. Quite a long time, but particularly Sunha Shraddha was worked and cared for Sangharakshita in the last years of his life, so he really kind of had an experience of knowing him, which in a way he can share with us. As I say, people like biography, people like stories of each other's lives, so it's an opportunity for all of us, because Sunha Shraddha knew Sangharakshita much, much better than I did. So it's an opportunity for all of us to get a bit of a sense of the man behind the teachings, the man behind the metta bhavana, the practice of ethics, and all of those different things which we talk about. So that's my spiel over. We're trying to fill him out for you a little bit. So I haven't decided what the first question is. Have you got anything to say about what I've just been saying?
It was interesting, you doing your biography and... just thinking about a story that he told. I think he told it to a few people, but he was quite a precocious child before he was bedridden. Quite naughty at times, which he always used to remind people with a little twinkle in his eye, a cheeky grin. And once his mother threatened him with a cane. She got a garden cane, and she threatened to give him a thrashing if he misbehaved again. So, and she put it in the cupboard in the kitchen. And he said, well, when she wasn't around, I went into the cupboard and I took it out and I slowly fed it into the cooker and burned it. He was very happy about that. It was never seen again.
There you go. So any parents in the room, you can consider that. Or not consider that. Or... yeah, anyway. That's...
I think what I liked about it, though, he wasn't... he wasn't cowed by it. He wasn't sort of... he didn't feel particularly threatened. He just sort of very practically and calmly dealt with the situation.
Yeah. Although he also is a... I remember him reading him saying that he also felt some regret at being such a demanding little brat at times, and that as an adult felt some sadness.
I can believe that.
So when did you first meet Sangha Ajahn?
That's an interesting question, given the list you've just mentioned, all these different kind of versions of Sangha Ajahn. I suppose in a way I first met Sangha Ajahn when I came along through the door of a Buddhist centre, which was, 23 years ago? No, 17.
When you were 17.
So in a way that was my first meeting with Sangha Ajahn, was actually meeting the movement and various order members and how they go about teaching the Dharma and reading books, reading Bounty's books.
And so what do you mean by that? Because normally we think of meeting people through meeting them, so...
Well, in a way, yeah, I mean, this is this sense of, you know, people work on different levels and there are different ways of meeting a person. So in a way, through walking through the door of a Buddhist centre, you're meeting Sangha Ajahn through his ideas of how the Dharma works.
Mm.
So he helped inspire and create this movement. So his ideas about how Buddhism kind of functions are kind of laced through everything we do.
Mm.
So through the fabric of this Buddhist centre, Sangha Ajahn lives, if you want to look at it like that.
Sure.
And then through the ideas and his teachings, which, you know, you and I as older members have practiced for years and trained in, again, you meet Sangha Ajahn through the way we practice.
Mm. So personally, I'm particularly interested in this idea of him kind of like, as an architect of a culture, as it were. So can you say a bit more about that? Like, what was it? Like, what do you think the defining features of that are?
I mean, certainly my impression of coming... it's a hard one to know, because in a way I haven't been to lots of other Buddhist movements and seen what the differences might be between us and them.
Mm.
To know if there are particularly defining features. But certainly for me, coming across a Buddhist centre, and I've heard it through a lot of other people's experience, there are things like it. They just are incredibly friendly places.
Yeah.
Not to say I'm sure other Buddhist movements are, but that certainly stands out for me in my personal experience of coming along. And I do think it is something, maybe there is something about it that's particular.
Mm.
To the Theravada Buddhist community, in that we do place, and Bhante certainly placed an awful lot of emphasis on friendship, on reaching out to people, making connections.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe that one. There are probably others.
Yeah. I don't think that. Just to stand the shot, I just said a word Bhante, so Sangha Ajahn was his kind of like his Dharma name, but. He obviously, that's quite a mouthful. Probably you're used to the mouthfulness with our names. You know, oh God. At some point, somebody said to him, Sangha Ajahn, like, what can we have something else to call you? And he said, well, Bhante is quite a traditional, very commonly used kind of title dash name in it.
It's an honorific.
It's an honorific, yeah.
It means venerable sir.
Yeah. But so venerable sir, but it's also quite affectionate. Like in a way, there's an affectionateness to it as well. So we'll talk, we'll pitch between saying Sangha Ajahn and Bhante. It's like his nickname, as it were. Not quite.
Yes, it just gets confusing sometimes.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning. So jumping ahead a bit. So your first encounter with Sangha Ajahn was through walking through the doors, kind of like. Coming into contact with a movement. And then can you remember your first actual physical meeting with him?
I mean, it wasn't very eventful, but I can't quite remember when it was, but we used to hold, when the movement was called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, and the order was called the Western Buddhist Order, we used to hold days to celebrate the founding of the order and the movement. So there'd be quite large gatherings that happened every year. I think I went on one of those, an FWBO day, I think it was in London, so late 90s, and he was still quite active.
Mm.
So he would have been wandering around, saying hello to people.
Mm.
Young things like me were kind of wondering whether or not to go and say hello. So I think I got one of my friends in the Nottingham Sangha and Order Member to introduce me.
Mm.
And he was like, oh, hello. Quite formal.
Yeah.
I didn't have very much to say. I was terribly shy.
Yeah.
And then he kind of wandered off.
Yeah.
So I think that was probably the first time I met him in person.
The first time I met him, it was, he used to live in Birmingham, and I used to work in a little team of Buddhists, and we went to visit him for afternoon tea. And my main memory of that experience was we brought him some fruit loaf, and I was cutting the loaf, and I was so nervous that my hand was shaking like this, and I had to physically kind of hold it to kind of cut the loaf. Again, like, I wasn't as young as you, but I must have been like 22, so I was lots of nervousness, shall we say.
Yeah. I mean, completely understandable. I mean, I can't quite imagine what was going through my head at like 17, 18. But then there's just like this huge age gap.
Yeah.
And not only that, but you've got a person who has set up a whole Buddhist order and movement.
Yeah.
And you read his books. So in a way, my first encounter with him was very different. It sets him up in a very particular way.
Yeah, yeah.
So that makes it very hard to then just meet him as another human being.
Yeah, yeah. Sangrachta, how's it going?
Yes, particularly through the eyes of a 17-year-old.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I had a number of kind of not directly one-to-one meetings over the years. Then, you know, in like study groups would go and stay at what used to be Majjhima Loka, and he'd come and have dinner with us, things like that.
Mm. And so, jumping ahead a bit more, so you went to kind of work for him in the last years of his life, as it were. Well, they were obviously the last years of his life. How did that happen, and how did you feel about that?
Yeah. I didn't expect it.
Mm.
Like, I really didn't expect it. I had been working in Cambridge for one of our largest kind of Buddhist businesses. It was a retail, wholesale, giftware company, Vintox Evolution. Unfortunately, that folded. So we had to close up and find other things to do.
Mm.
I went down to Brighton to help a dear friend kind of set up a little shop.
Mm.
And then I think the first week I was there, I just packed up everything in Cambridge and moved down. We were setting up a new community, starting the shop. Not everyone was there yet. Mm. I was kind of there on my own.
Mm.
And I got a call from my preceptor, Sadaraja, gave me my name. Mm. And he said, yes, I've been talking to the team that look after Banti, and they were wondering if you'd like to be his secretary. And what did I think?
Hmm.
And I thought it was a very good idea. So what do you think? And I'm sitting in a chip shop in Brighton having this conversation. And I'm just like, I could feel myself welling up, which was really like, I don't know why I was welling up. It wasn't like, in a way, I didn't know what it meant.
Hmm.
But something about it really stirred me.
Hmm.
It felt like an honour in a way to be asked.
Because
I didn't really know him. So that's kind of what happened. And then I had this awkward situation where I'd just gone down to do a whole thing in Brighton with a dear friend.
Mm.
Like, I knew I wasn't going to do that forever anyway, so it's like, how do I extract myself as skillfully as possible from this thing that I've just started doing and say yes? So I really had to give it a good week and really think it over. And I said that to them. I spoke to Mahamati, who became my boss.
Mm.
He was the head of the charity that looked after Banti. And he was great. He was very kind of course, yes, you must make sure that you decide to do it for yourself and whatever you need to do to leave well in Brighton if you make that decision. He was great. Mm. Very good man.
So then tell us a bit more about it feeling like an honour, because that's quite... It's one of those interesting words, isn't it? Like, our culture's not that into the idea of honour, or I suppose it's quite cynical about honour. You know, we have the honours roll every year, and everyone's like, yeah, yeah, whatever. Maybe that's just me. I don't know how to explain it.
Because it was, like, I was surprised at myself. I mean, it was just a conversation on the telephone. And I didn't know, in a way, I didn't know Banti personally very well. Maybe it is that mix of the combination. I mean, I do find myself to be quite a devotional Buddhist. That does seem to be my particular bent in spiritual life. My direction, as it were. So one has to bear that in mind, that I'm sort of naturally quite devotional. He's the head of the movement and the order that I joined. So that's put those two things together. And then, it's just years of kind of, in a way, building my life around his vision. And then being offered the opportunity to serve him. I suppose in a way it's not that surprising that I did well.
And what was it like to serve him? Like, that's another kind of not particularly popular or kind of a word which easily triggers kind of cynicism.
It's funny, I find that strange. I think service is the most amazing thing. If you find someone to serve, I think it's great. It's a lovely, lovely thing to do with your life, to serve. Particularly if it's a higher vision, something that's actually going to uplift yourself and other people. What was it like to serve Banti? I mean, in a way, terribly ordinary. In a way. There are other sides to that, but that, in a way, was one of the things I loved most about spending time with Sangharakshita, was he was so straightforward. On one level, he was just a really straightforward, sweet, 90-something-year-old man. I think the extraordinary thing about that, though, was he was like that all the time. It didn't seem to matter what came his way. And certainly in those last few years, there were difficulties that came his way. His health was very bad at times. Various things kind of came up. There were criticisms from people that he cared about. And complaints and things like that. But he was always that sort of very straightforward, friendly, nice 90-year-old man. I didn't know him when he was younger, but I knew him for that chunk of time. In some ways, just very impressed with how straightforward it was.
So can you say a little bit more, because that's like this image of straightforwardness you mentioned that several times. So it's like, can you just kind of fill that out for us? Like, what was that like? Or what did that look like in your actual interactions with him? Or
when I first arrived at Adishtana, I moved up in the summer, and I think I had about a week before I started work. I was quite nervous, because I was just like, I had no idea if I could do this job. Like, in my head, the idea of being a secretary requires certain skills, which I am not known for. You know, dictation and typing and spelling and the use of grammar. I was quite nervous about that, given that Sangharakshita has such a love of writing and is very literary. I was quite nervous and I didn't know if it was going to work. But I thought, we'll give it a go and see how it goes. So I had about a week before I started, and a few people came to me and said, "Is your name?" Which I thought was rather odd. I said, "Well, my name's Starna Shraddhar." He said, "Oh, because Banti thinks it's Starma Shraddhar." Okay. I said, "Well, no, that's not what I was given. That's not the name I was ordained with." And I said, "Oh, well, he seems to think..." And so what does it mean? I said, "Well, this is what it means." I said, okay. I was like, "Well, I'll tell him when I see him." So in a way, that was our first kind of day. It was me going in to sit with him and do correspondence. And I said, "Good morning, Banti." And he said, "Good morning, Starma Shraddhar." And I said, "Oh, what did you say, Banti?" He said, "Starma Shraddhar, that is your name, isn't it?" I said, "No, Banti, it is not. That's not the name I was given." And I had to tell him. And he said, "Oh, so what does Starna mean?" And I said, well, it means the quality of strength or firmness. He said, I thought that's what stama meant. And that was the end of that conversation.
He's like,
yeah. And then from then on, he called me Stana Shraddha. Mm. And that is pretty much usually how we greeted each other in the mornings for 3.5 years.
Mm.
I'd walk in and I'd say, good morning, Bhante. And he'd always reply. And so, yeah. There was no quibbling about it.
Mm.
Very straightforward.
And did he... So I suppose, because obviously part of your job was arranging for people to come and visit Bhante and kind of showing them in and blah, blah, blah. So that, which is, like, he did a tremendous amount of that in the last years of his life. Can you tell us anything? Like, what was that like? That, can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, so in a way... I had various responsibilities, but you could probably break them down into two. So the main one was his correspondence.
Mm.
So I was there to be his secretary. So all the incoming letters, emails, postcards, gifts, whatever they were, that was for me to then pass on to him because his eyesight was of a state that he couldn't read anymore.
Mm.
So I read all his correspondence to him and dictated. So he would dictate to me anything he wanted to send to anyone.
Mm.
He got quite... I think he really rather enjoyed emails because they were so quick.
Yeah.
You know, you could definitely see the difference. Then once he couldn't write his own letters, yes, I think he definitely came to appreciate writing emails because they were so immediate. And you could just finish it and send it and it was gone. There was none of that possibility of a letter being mislaid by your secretary or anything like that. They just went.
Mm.
And he rather enjoyed that. And then the other main thing was, yes, organising people to be able to see him. But all sorts of things, really. I mean, in a way, it was slightly nerve-wracking at times because it was always dependent on how he was. So we didn't ever know... if he'd be able to see anyone until he sort of got up and had his breakfast.
Yeah.
But people might plan to come to Adishtana months in advance and they'd be asking to see him months in advance. So I had to sort of hold that as best one could. I mean, in a way, it worked quite well. We did come up with a half-decent system. But it was always letting people know that nothing was guaranteed.
Sure.
Until we knew that morning. But yeah, I mean, it was a joy as well to sometimes, you know, show a very nervous individual, right from people that had just met movement, through to order members that had been around for a few years but had never met him one-to-one. Sometimes the order members were more nervous than other people.
Sure.
But showing very nervous people through, and then they'd come out beaming, sometimes slightly stunned, like they didn't quite know what had happened. But usually, yes, they'd come out beaming. They're very, very happy, and I think he loved that, particularly in the last few years, because in a way, it just he met so many people, and he could have very interesting conversations with all sorts of people.
And any particular little kind of like vignettes which stand out?
I can't think of any.
I'll tell you one of mine while you're thinking. So one of the less known parts of our movement's work is with gypsies in Hungary. Very, very oppressed people. It was really tough for them. And there's a few of them who made contact with Buddhism, and we took some of them to meet Sangharakshita. And one of them particularly is this really big kind of gypsy guy called Janos, and he's very, very, very interesting, very lovely man. So a couple of things happened. One of them is the day before we went to see Sangharakshita, he saw a ghost. And it comes from a very traditional society which just believes in ghosts. And my boss has kind of tried the whole kind of rational we don't believe in ghosts thing on him, which really didn't work at all, actually. He was just like, I saw a ghost. It's like, whatever. And so my boss, Sabuti, said, well, you know, you're going to see Sankresh to ask him what he thinks of it. So we took him there, and it was a long drive. So it's like a 3-hour drive just to meet Sankresh. This is the sort of thing people do. So we took them, and two things happened. One of them is we took them in to see Sankresh, and they came out like 15 minutes later. And it's like, for God's sake, it's just like, that's a 3-hour drive for a 15-minute conversation. It's like, pissed off about that. But actually, particularly this guy, Janosz, who's just very, it's very hard to imagine, but it's just like, he's just from a completely different background, you know, like his mother would have been illiterate, kind of really tough life. And he just came out and he said, oh, that man, his mind is so clean. And he says that this, I'm crap at accents, but yeah, very, very struck by that. Mm-hmm. But the other thing he said to Sven, Sabuti said to him, so did you ask him about the ghost? And Sankresh said, yeah, I saw a ghost yesterday. Ghosts happen. And then he was like, oh yeah, and they said, what did he say? Oh yeah, and the ghost said to me, oh, hello, Bunty, in this very particular kind of Indian English accent. So it was, oh yeah, I guess it was an Indian friend who died recently, and their kind of spirit on the way out came to say hello. Very just, just very kind of open to a whole world of experience, not very kind of open to what people actually experience rather than fixing it or tying it down. You had a chance to think of a story?
No, but it was, you said about, I mean, that drive of 3 hours there and then 3 hours back for 15 minutes. Mm. But those 15 minutes could really mean a lot for someone.
Sure.
I know we don't want to get too caught up on kind of special personal teachers and all that kind of thing. But, I mean, those meetings sometimes really did have quite an effect on people.
Mm. Yeah.
And I always knew that being his secretary at that time of his life, unless the job drove me mad, which it was showing no signs of doing, I would be there until he died.
Mm.
And I kind of took that on because I didn't want him to go through another secretary change, because those kinds of changes were not easy for him, because it means having to get used to a whole new person and how they work and how to work with him. So I really didn't want to do that to him. But that meant that I also knew that at some point there were going to be people that wanted to see him. I wouldn't be able to because he would die. Yeah. So when he did die, there were people at Adhishtana that were hoping to see him.
The next day, wow. Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah,
so I knew that the people that travelled and there were people on the list that were going to come in a few weeks' time and 2 or 3 months' time. And I knew all those people were like, that's just not going to happen now.
Yeah.
And it won't ever happen again.
Mm.
So, those meetings were really important. And I think that's possibly one of the reasons why he loved doing it as well. Yeah. I think there was something about him at the end of his life that in a way was more powerful than he was when he was 40 or 50, in a very different sort of way. It was that kind of bountiful old man, just giving, whatever he could. And if that was a 10-minute meeting with someone, he'd do his best to just give it.
Yeah.
And some days he really wasn't very well,
but
still he wanted to see people. Some days he couldn't. But there was something about that at the end of his life that he just gave, actually. Yeah.
Which is, it's quite remarkable for a 93-year-old. It's like they, sure, your experience of people as they age, very classically, they really do shut down, don't they? Become very obsessed with their dinner. It's my experience of old people. So it's like, no disrespect to my dearly departed grandparents, but it's like, anyway, it's not about me. And another thing. But yeah, so it's quite remarkable actually, just day after day. It's like, oh, hello, who are you? Oh, hello, who are you? So, and did he give you any advice, any little teachings?
Oh, gosh. People have asked me that before, and in some ways I feel foolish that I never had those kinds of conversations with him. I never sort of felt like I had questions that I wanted answering, not by him. But I've got so many little memories of just stuff that happened that I'm very, very grateful for. One of the things, I can't remember how the conversation went, but we got talking about, you know, how it can be a little awkward sometimes for people when they go and see him because they don't quite know what to say or talk about. And he just said, well, I just find something they're interested in. You know, whatever that is. You know, we don't have to talk about the Dharma. They might be interested in weaving or something like that. So I think he was having a little poke at me because at the time I was quite into weaving and all these different craft projects and things that I was getting into. And he said, well, you know, I'd find what it was that they were interested in. We talk about that because that's where the energy was. And then you've got a conversation. And he was very good at that. So that was a little something, you sort of had a little, you know, pass something on. But just, I remember just beautiful moments. There was a particular ritual we did after his 90th birthday. We had all these little birthday messages that people had sent in with things for him. And they wanted me to, someone asked me, would I make a card out of them? Like, you know, 200-300 little bits of paper with messages on. Don't know how they thought I was going to make a card out of them. So then they said, well, why don't we put them in something and we can, that can be significant or special. And then it was like, well, why don't we put them in a rupa? So then we sort of devised this whole ritual of putting all these little messages inside a rupa and putting mantras on them. So we basically kind of consecrating a rupa.
And filling rupa meaning Buddha statue, yeah.
And then in some way that can be sort of gift to Bhante. But I remember going and talking to him and saying, well, look, I know there are all these different rituals that, say, Tibetans do or different Buddhists do about filling Buddha statues, filling rupas. What would you put inside? You know, they're specific things. So we had this lovely conversation of just, you know, so he was pulling out things from his memories of being in Tibet and being shown how to consecrate rupas, which I never knew. And then at one point I was like, okay, well, I want to put this central stick in the middle of the rupa and it'd be really nice if we had something personally from you to put on it. And he was like, oh, great. Just reach up on top of that bookcase and bring down that box. So I got down this box and he said, open it up. And it's just full of all these little parcels and boxes. And he said, well, what's in that drawer? And open that up. I spent like half an hour with him just going through basically a little treasure box of all these little things that people had given him over the years. And he said, well, what's that? Because he couldn't quite see it. And I'd tell him what it was and hand it to him and he'd feel it. And he'd be, yes, okay, let's have that. So we picked out this thing. And at the end of it, I had three little things that he'd given me that we could put inside the rupa. And it was just like this special, magical little interaction that I would take to my grave with me. Just a few of those dotted through that 3.5 years. They're just very special. I remember writing something after he died. A few people were writing sort of memories. I think they were going to compile it into a book. And I thought it was probably time to sort of try and bring myself to say something about it. And some of the abiding things were just, like I had a lot of lunches with him. I used to cook him lunch. I think for about a year I cooked him lunch every day. And I'd sit and have lunch with him. That's what you did. If you cooked lunch, you'd have lunch with him. So I'd eat with one person. And I'd always stand when he came into the room. And when we finished the meal and he was ready to leave, I'd always stand until he left the room. Partly because I was worried that he might stumble, you know, as he was getting older. It did sort of become harder and harder for him just to stand up from a dinner chair. He never stumbled. He was so mindful. But it just felt like the right thing to do. To just, you know, revere him in that way. And I'll always remember him when he'd sit down in his second favourite chair to listen to audiobooks. He'd sort of have his little Zimmer frame and he'd sort of swivel around, sort of back up to the chair. And I just always remember his hand going out into the air to find that arm of the chair. And then he'd get hold of the arm of the chair and he'd just launch himself backwards. But yeah, little memories like that. There was the, well, we were talking about this one the other day, weren't we? There's always the slightly mysterious, coincidental things that happen as well. Like his 90th birthday, there was a big gathering at Adishtama of the order. It was a big order weekend. And they'd asked Bansi if he would come, but he hadn't been in a public setting for...
a couple of years?
At least 2, 3, maybe 4 years, because his health had really not been very good. Mm. And people would start to wonder if he'd ever sort of come to a public gathering again.
Sure.
But he said he'd think about it. And I think right up until the afternoon, he hadn't really made his mind up if he was going to come over or not. And people were like, is he going to come? Is he not going to come? Do we set something up? Do we not put a chair out for him? Do we put a chair out for him? Toing it, throw it. And eventually I was kind of hanging out with some of my friends on the order weekend, and one of the other people from the team that was with Bounty said, look, he's decided to come. I think it's like half an hour to spare. And me and one of my friends, we went into the annex where Bounty had been staying. I think he was in another room. We grabbed one of his armchairs and sort of walked it out of the flat, and then had to run across the field to put it in the marquee, because we were all out in the marquee. And just as we were heading across the field, it was the most gloriously hot, sunny weekend, a bit like the one we've just had, the bank holiday. And as we headed out across the field, these big drops of rain started to fall, like very slowly. You know, like when those big summer showers start to come on, they start with just those big, slow drops of rain. I'm just starting to fall. I was like, this chair's going to get wet. So I covered it with the blanket as we were trying to run. And we got it into the marquee, and everyone was there. And then it just absolutely tipped it. And then he was driven across the field in the car. And we were all in the tent. There must have been... must have been 200-300 of us in the marquee, and we were chanting the Shakyamuni mantra when he came in. And he sort of makes his way into the marquee, and there's people holding umbrellas to get him from the car into the marquee, because it was just absolutely hammering it down. And he got in there, and there's just something about Bounty coming into a gathering like that, and it always happened with me. It didn't matter that I'd been his secretary for 3 years. You know, that felt very straightforward in Audrey, but when he walked into a gathering of a lot of people, I just used to cry. I couldn't help myself. I remember coming out for his birthday once, and we were sang him happy birthday in the courtyard. I was just weeping. And the same, so he walked into the market and I was just crying. Just very moved, really. I think that is a different Sangharachita to the one that I met doing secretary work. It sort of connects on a different level. It's kind of more archetypal. But yeah, he was there. There was a book launch. It was hammering it down with rain. And people were peering out of the tent. And apparently there were massive rainbows everywhere. Double ones. And he does have a bit of a thing in his life of these rainbows cropping up. But there are all these rainbows all over the place. And I think by the time they finished the book launch and he'd sat there and we'd given him the gift of lots of money to get the complete works off the ground and a big card and that sort of thing, the sun came out again and he left.
But it was weird.
The sun came back out again. And
life continued.
It was very strange. So things like that happened every now and then.
So let's just, we've rambled on, so we've got a little bit of time if anyone's got any questions they'd like to ask. Anything we haven't quite evoked?
Thank you, Stanishad. I suppose I should have said thank you first.
Thank you.
Quite all right.
Yeah.